Next, Monitor invites you to Meet the Press, America's press conference of the year, and winner of every major award in its field. Our guest today is Undersecretary of State Chester Bowles. We'll bring you today's program in a moment after this message.
This is Morgan Beatty. The world stands at the threshold of a decade dominated by science. Important breakthroughs will occur in a number of significant fields: molecular biology, high-energy physics, astronautics, radio astronomy. These sciences, with strange-sounding names, will initiate vast changes that will be felt in the social and political life of the nations. In short, science will be an undercurrent shaping the news in the decade ahead. To follow the exciting developments, you can depend on the accuracy and the speed of NBC Radio News. Reporters in leading world capitals, stand by, ready to go wherever the news is happening, ready to bring you on-the-scene coverage using the speed of modern electronics. From these worldwide correspondents, you get a necessary perspective on the major news events of our time. It's important to follow the future as it develops today, hour by hour, on NBC Radio News.
Today, Americans own more United States savings bonds than ever before. They're better than ever. Higher interest, for one thing, and they mature faster, too. Also, keep this in mind if you're planning ahead for retirement. Buy United States savings bonds now, the familiar Series E bonds. Then, when you feel the need for retirement income, you can exchange your E-bonds for H-bonds and take the interest as it's earned. Another good reason to buy and hold United States savings bonds. Today's guest on Meet the Press is Undersecretary of State Chester Bowles. Undersecretary Bowles, a former congressman, United States ambassador to India, and governor of Connecticut, has been one of President Kennedy's top foreign policy advisors since the presidential campaign. Our panel, James Reston of the New York Times, Stuart Hensley of UPI, and Lawrence E. Spivak. Ned Brooks will moderate.
Mr. Chester Bowles, who is our guest today, has held a number of important positions in public life: wartime administrator of price controls, ambassador to India, governor of Connecticut, member of Congress, and now Undersecretary of State. He was appointed to his present position after serving as President Kennedy's foreign policy advisor during the presidential campaign. At the Democratic Convention in Los Angeles, he was chairman of the committee which drafted the party platform. This week, Secretary Bowles became the center of rumor and speculation that he might be leaving his job. President Kennedy stepped in, but he did not entirely silence the rumors when he said, "My judgment is now that Mr. Bowles should stay as Undersecretary of State. If there is going to be any change, I will make it clear at that time." And there the matter stands at this moment. And now we're ready to start the questions. Mr. Spivak.
Mr. Bowles, there's still a great deal of speculation, as Mr. Brooks said, about you and your job. Is there any basis of truth in the reports that were so widely circulated that you would be leaving your job soon?
No, I have no intention, Mr. Spivak, of leaving my job. The president has not requested, and certainly I haven't. I think it's an important job, and I intend to stay with it as long as I can do it productively.
Was there any truth at all, though, in the reports that the subject was being considered?
I don't think you ever want to discuss conversations with the president. I think those questions are best asked to the president. But I am happy there. The president's made it clear he wants me to stay there, and that's exactly what I'm doing.
Well, Mr. Bowles, you have been quoted as saying that the talk about your possible resignation was mostly a press-created storm.
I think that's largely true.
Are you saying, then, that the press created this storm entirely? Wouldn't that be charging the press with irresponsible
No, act? I think the press has been quite responsible in it. But I think that story, this is a pretty, you know this city as well as I do, perhaps better, Mr. Spivak. These things blow up in Washington every now and then, and this is one of these ones that I've seen come and go many, many times, as you have.
It wasn't
wholly press created, I'm sure. There are all kinds of rumors and stories, and often they are. But I think the whole thing has settled down. I think we're back at work, and I'm leaving tomorrow, and I'm perfectly content.
Are we to understand, then, that you have had assurance that when you return, you will continue as Undersecretary?
That's right. I'm planning to continue my present job.
Mr. Reston.
Mr. Secretary, following that question for just a minute, could you tell us, in the light of what you said, why the President then called you in to talk to you about this question, if there was no problem?
Well, the President talked to me about foreign policy generally and about the great problems of administering foreign policy. And I would like to say that I've known the President for a long time, for the last year or so, very well, I think, and intimately. And I've never been better impressed with his views, nor have I ever felt that they were closer to my own than I felt in the last week or two. He was brilliant in what he stated that he wanted in the world, what he was trying to get for the American people and for the world in a way of peace and some measure of stability. I never felt closer to him than I have in these last two or three days in regard to his ideas and mine.
What was your understanding of your job when you took it, and is it any different as it has worked out in terms,
well,
particularly of policymaking?
You naturally learn a lot in 6 months, and I've learned a great deal, I think, in this particular 6 months. The Undersecretary of State, as you know, will always be a somewhat different job depending on who's in it. There's been a lot of mistaken things written to the effect that I did not want to take this job as an administrative job. This is just not the case. A lot of my work in the last 20 years has been administrative. I started my own business and ran it. I ran one of the biggest wartime agencies, the War Office of Price Administration. I was governor of a large state. I had the task of reorganizing one of the major embassies in the world. I like administration. I think it's basic to policy making. I had a feeling when I took this job, and I feel it now very, very strongly, that administration is one of the most important aspects of the Undersecretary of State. As a matter of fact, there's only been one individual who was brought into that job purely on that basis, and that was Jim Webb, who you may remember was head of the Bureau of the Budget and came in purely as an administrator. I came in as an administrator plus a generalist, and I think that's the way the job should be. I have two deputies, as you perhaps know, one on administration, Roger Jones, and one on political matters and affairs, Alexis Johnson. They're two very able men. One is responsible for people and things, shipments and all the rest, Roger Jones. The other is responsible for policy adjustment and follow through in the agency. They're both very top men doing very, very well, and this is the apparatus.
Mm-hmm. Mr. McCormick.
Now, running through all the stories, Mr. Bowles, was the theme that one of the sources of dissatisfaction was the fact that it took 6 weeks for us to answer Khrushchev's note that he gave to Mr. Kennedy after the Vienna talk. Why did it take 6 weeks?
Well, the world is pretty complicated, as I think we'll all agree. And I think it'd be very easy to get the wrong answer in 4 or 5 days or 2 or 3 weeks. I think the important thing is to get a balanced reply, and I think we did. It took some time. I don't think that's surprising.
Well, but on the other hand, the situation was not unique, nor could it possibly have been unexpected. Shouldn't we, if we have any planning at all, have been prepared for a routine emergency such as that, particularly since our answer after 6 weeks itself was pretty routine?
Well, this is true, but you have to deal not only with all the different viewpoints in the department and in Washington, but you also have to deal with various agencies in Washington and also our allies. And all this has to be talked out and talked through with them. And I think the important thing to do is to get a good, sound answer. I think.
But it wasn't talked out ahead of time. We waited until it actually happened again before we thrashed it out?
No. I think there's a continuing study of German policy and Berlin policy. It's been going on for years, of course. And you draw on the past background of what you've learned from previous experience. But we were presented now with some very rather different phases and angles. Mr. Khrushchev is throwing the book at us, I think, pretty hard. I think it's awfully important to be sound and solid with all the agencies in Washington, with the President, and with our allies, so we can work together and act together, which is desperately needed now. There are many, many memoranda or letters. They've taken more than 6 weeks to answer.
Would there be any way to guess how much of that time was consumed by our allies and how much by us?
I think it's about 50-50.
Mr. Hensley.
Mr. Bowles, in connection with the recent discussion about your employment, this matter doesn't bear directly on that. But there have been reports that the liberal elements in the Democratic Party have been somewhat saddened by the fact that they felt that their influence wasn't as dominant now in the New Frontier as they had thought it would be. Do you feel that the liberal element, the liberal influence has been diluted by the political realities?
I don't think it's been diluted one bit. I think Senator Kennedy, running for the presidency of the United States on a liberal platform, a liberal program, as a liberal candidate, won an election. It was close, to be sure. But he is following through on that philosophy, and that program is clearly and well, I think, as any person could possibly be expected to do. I just want to say again that in the last 2 or 3 weeks, I've never been more impressed or as impressed with how right he is on the questions involving our future as I think he is today.
Well, now that we have solidarity in the upper echelons...
Not always completely, but...
I would like to ask something about the policy which is emerging from those echelons. With respect to Berlin, which Mr. McCormick mentioned, the administration seems to be talking in extremes. I mean, we will not get out of Berlin. We will fight to stay in Berlin, but there's no talk about anything in between. If Khrushchev makes a separate peace treaty with East Germany and says you have to deal with them, would you rather fight a nuclear war than deal with the East Germans?
Well, I think that's a choice I hope we don't have to make. I don't think we will have to make it. As you know, the president is going to speak on all this Tuesday night on his own program, where he'll explain the administration view. I think it'd be presumptuous for me tonight to talk about my views. I do feel one point very strongly, though, that I think we're all together and agreeing on, and that is that it's pretty dangerous business if we ever allow the Soviet Union to push us out of a situation where our legal rights are very, very clear. If this occurs once, it'll occur again. People may say, well, Berlin isn't worth the trouble. Berlin isn't worth this. Why don't we compromise on that particular point and take the next one? This would be the beginning of a whole series of compromises that would be all wrong, very dangerous, and I think would lead us into further and further trouble. At the same time, there is a large area for negotiation and discussion, and I think this should all be taken advantage of, and I believe it will be.
Well, one of the criticisms which was frequently made of the previous administration was that it never had a policy. It simply reacted.
That's right.
One of the criticisms
I
being...
I made this criticism
you
myself.
Did. One of the criticisms of the present administration is that it doesn't have a policy on Berlin. It just simply has a position. Do you think that a policy is going to emerge?
I think I know what our policy is, and I think it's very sound. I'm in full agreement with it. I think the president on Tuesday night will open up a lot for discussion.
Mr. Spivak.
May I take you from Berlin to communist China? There have been contradictory stories published on what the U.S. planned to do in the U.N. on the question of the admission of communist China. Will you tell us what our position is there?
Well, I don't think it's quite clear yet because I don't think what the situation is quite clear, Mr. Spivak. The UN situation in the fall may be one way or maybe another. As you know, we've kept Communist China out by the so-called moratorium on discussion in the General Assembly. This requires a majority vote, which we've always been able to get in the past. Most of the experts who are working very hard to find out what the other delegations think feel that we'll not be able to get a majority vote this year against the discussion of the subject in the General Assembly. Now,
the question,
this
Mr. Ball,
may
is
change.
What are we going to? Yes, but the question is, what is our position? What are we going to do?
We're
going to
try. Wait? We'll try first to get the moratorium. We'll see where we go from there.
We're going to fight for a moratorium, just
as we have in the past.
As we did before. And what do you mean when you say we'll see what we're going to do, go from
well,
there?
Well, that time a new situation will develop if we fail to get, or if it's apparent that we fail to get it. And then there are any one of 2 or 3 roads that we can go up. These have been all pretty fully explored, and I think we know where we'll go in those circumstances, but I don't think it's ready to be talked about yet.
Well, there has been a good deal of talk about it.
I think
our ambassador is back from Formosa, and after a meeting at the White House, said that we're going to fight to keep Chiang Kai-shek in and to keep the communist China out.
That's
Is that
correct.
Still our policy?
That's still our policy.
Mr. Reston.
On that same question, is it your view that this is a vetoable question?
Well, there's a lot of argument on this, as you know, and I suppose it eventually would go to the World Court to be settled. The lawyers argue about it. I are in disagreement. Some think it is, some think it isn't.
The previous administration took the position that it would exercise its veto against the admission of Red China. What is the position of this government on that?
Well, I think that'll have to develop as far as the question develops, but I think if this were our position, it would undoubtedly be challenged and would go to courts.
In that same area of the world, what ever happened after the great debates about Quemoy and Matsu? Has anything been done about that whole thing since Kennedy
came? Well, Chiang Kai-shek is still there, and the islands are strongly defended. Their defenses have been very strengthened, I guess, as you know. And Mao, at the moment, apparently has his own troubles at home, and it has been pressing the point very hard.
Mm-hmm. What kind of information do we have about his troubles, Mr. Secretary?
Well, the troubles seem to be pretty serious, and I have a strong feeling that they're much more deeply rooted and broader than many people think. Lots of people say that the Chinese communists are having trouble growing food because they're Marxists, and Karl Marx was a city boy and didn't know about plows and shovels and dirt. I think it's more complicated than that. There's a tremendous basic lack of land in China. Chinese have been basically good farmers always. But there's an enormous lack of land. It's hard for us to visualize it. About 1.8 acres for every family. There's no commercial fertilizer of any massive amounts. And they're just going to have, I think, an indefinite hard time feeding their people. This year is a particularly tough year. Now, I'm not sure this is the most explosive single fact, perhaps, in the world. Because if they start to move south into the Mekong Valley and the Irrawaddy Valley, which could feed many millions and tens of millions of Chinese, this could bring on, of course, some very serious troubles.
Aren't they going to have to move south if they go on increasing their population by 16 million a year?
This is the concern. They could, of course, do three things. They could make a deal with the Soviet Union to share some of the extra land that the Soviet has. I doubt the Soviet would welcome such an agreement. Or they could explode south into the very lush and not too populated areas of the southeast, Southeast Asia, where they've gone on other occasions. Or they could change their mind and start to trade for their food and buy it as other nations do. Now, they are buying some wheat, of course, and other foodstuffs from Australia and Canada. They're having a hard time getting the dollars and the pound sterling to pay for it. And this, of course, is a development for the future. It may well be that the time will come someday when the American farmer may offer China an alternative to aggression. I could conceive of this happening 5 or 10 years from now.
Spell that out. I don't get that.
Well, if China, communist China, attempts to move in the classic situation south to Southeast Asia, we'll have to oppose it, of course, and throw everything we can away. We're pledged to that, and we have to do it and should. Conceivably, if China will, over the years, modify some of these aggressive tendencies, and I see no signs of her doing it today, the American farmer and the capacity of America to grow food may take some of the steam out of this Chinese political boiler.
Mr. McCormick.
Mr. Bowles, during the campaign, we were promised a new, invigorated, and rejuvenated foreign policy. Can you suggest for us any specific instances of significant improvements or changes in our foreign approach in the 6 months of the administration?
I think I can. I think that we, for instance, in Latin America, the President's program, which he announced last winter, is the first really positive approach to Latin American affairs in my memory since the Good Neighbor policy of FDR's days. This is a program that calls on the Latin American countries to make certain sacrifices in their own behalf, to put their own economic house in order, to tax their people adequately, to put through land reform so their people can have a feeling of belonging and participating in the growth of their country. In return for these reforms, we've offered substantial help and assistance in economic affairs and technical assistance. This is a whole new program for our neighbors to the south. I think our whole approach to Africa has been very different. I think it's been more positive, in my opinion, more effective. We're on a much closer basis there than we've been before. Africa, of course, is terribly dangerous, and confused, complex, and no easy answers to it. Maybe there are no answers at all for the time being. But I think we're doing much better there than we've done before.
Well, aside from Latin America, which I certainly would concede personally, have we taken the initiative from the Soviet anywhere else in Southeast Asia, for example?
I think we've taken it in Africa a good deal. A year ago, we were wondering about a lot of these countries running back and forth to Moscow and getting very nervous and biting our fingernails every time anybody had a drink with Mr. Khrushchev. I think we're taking this a little bit more in our stride now. We're learning that these people are basic nationalists, that they want their own freedom, their own independence. This is the important thing, and we're trying to help them. And I think we have the initiative very definitely in Africa as far as the Soviets are concerned. I don't know how long we'll keep it. I hope we'll keep it.
Mr. Hensley.
Mr. Bowles, with due deference to your reluctance to scoop Mr. Kennedy on his Tuesday night speech, I'd just like an explanation of one thing, and that is why, considering the Berlin situation to be the threat to the peace that it is, the United States has not taken it to the United Nations as yet.
Well, the United Nations, of course, is not in session. Of course, the Security Council could be called any time. I think all this belongs to the later stages of the developing program that Mr. Kennedy will undoubtedly explain and open up for discussion on Tuesday. I would not doubt at all that we would be in the United Nations, both in the Security Council and probably in the General Assembly before we're through. I think we have great advantages there, and I think the Soviet Union is at a great disadvantage in the UN. After all, right now in Berlin, it's midnight, and people are going home from the theater, the movies, they're walking through their parks, there's peace there, the children in bed, people are quiet, nobody's in great difficulties, people are reasonably happy, and Khrushchev says, I'm going to move in and destroy this and change it.
Well, just
and I think we've got to bring this home to the world, that he is trying to change the situation by force and by threat of force, that the people involved do not want changed.
On the other side of the Brandenburg Gate, people are not quite so happy. There
not so
are
happy.
Refugees streaming into West Berlin, and there are reports of unrest, greater unrest than ever in East Germany. Do you have any information that would indicate that there's likely to be an explosion or uprising there of the sort that we had in 1953?
I would think that Mr. Khrushchev would worry about it. And I think what your point is so right. We sit around so often critical of our own policies, and we're right to criticize. And we've got to improve them. We've got to do a better job. But when I think of our headaches, I sometimes feel just a little bit better to think of Khrushchev's. The number of situations around the world which are not working to his advantage, where he is in trouble, where things are not going well for him. We're getting a sort of a complex that the communists are moving ahead like some great force that can't be stopped. This just isn't so.
Well,
the communists have failed in many, many areas. And we've been clumsy, too. Let's admit it.
Speaking of the situations elsewhere around the world, do you think there's any possibility that Mr. Khrushchev might take advantage of our almost complete preoccupation at the moment with Berlin to turn on the pressure somewhere else?
I think he might. This has been done before. About the time you get all braced for pressure in Berlin, you may get it again at Kwamoyamatsu or Southeast Asia or somewhere else. But I think we've taken this pretty well into account and are pretty ready for it. I don't think we'd be surprised by it.
Mr. Spivak.
Mr. Bowles, before President Kennedy came to office, you had this to say about the German policy of the last administration, and I quote it. Said it was largely limited to such unrealistic and non-negotiable items as reunification based on immediate free elections. End of quote. What do you consider a realistic German policy now, if it isn't to be based on that?
Again, I'll leave that to President Tuesday night, but I would say that...
Will he spell out a realistic German policy?
I think he will make... It'll be an excellent speech Tuesday night, and will open up a lot for discussion, and there will be a great debate, and this is good. This is what America is all about. But I don't think there's any realistic basis right now to expect Germany to be united. We want a united Germany. We want the right of all Germans to live together in their own country. But to expect Germany to be united right now with free elections, I think, is fantasy.
But what is there that is negotiable today on the West Berlin situation?
Well, I think the whole Central European situation has negotiable elements in it. I think the whole question of armed forces all across Europe and Asia, too, has certain aspects that are very negotiable. Depends on whether the Soviet wants to negotiate. If they don't want to negotiate, they can't. Obviously, there's nothing to negotiate.
Are you talking now about neutralizing some of Germany?
No, I'm not a subscriber to this neutral belt. I think this is nonsense, and I think this is just a ditch that will be jumped very easily. I don't think that a neutral Germany is in the interest of any of us, certainly not ours. I also think it's essential that West Germany remain part of the common market and part of the whole picture of NATO and Europe. What we want is a stronger, unified Europe. As this kind of a Europe develops, it'll exert a pull on the peoples to the east, the Poles, Hungarians, the Czechs, Romanians, and Bulgarians. Europe will become a force, a growing force, that will be offer an exciting future to the young people of Europe. And this is what we should stand for. We should see Europe in these terms.
And you think Mr. Khrushchev wants that?
I don't think he wants it.
You think he's going to allow this in his negotiations?
Well, there are various elements. He's not altogether a free agent. He has certain forces he has to deal with, too. And we have great power, I think, on our side that is often forgotten. Economic power. The possibility of making things very difficult for him.
Gentlemen, we have about 1 minute remaining. Mr. Reston.
I'd like to come back to that in a minute, but were you absolutely fair to Doug Dillon in your appreciation of the Latin American policy? What's new about your Latin American policy that Dillon didn't spell out at Bogota?
That's perfectly true. He did, and I have a great respect for him. You can't pick a fight between Doug Dillon and myself, because I think he's a great man. And I think the Bogota conference was the beginning of a policy that is an exciting opportunity for all of us.
Would you spell out the economic pressure we can put on Germany as on Russia in Germany as a counter to military measures?
Well, the whole course, the trade of West Germany with East Germany is very great and very important. The NATO countries do a great deal of trading with the various Warsaw Pact nations. There's also the Dardanelles and the Baltic, where it seems to me there are opportunities.
A blockade, you mean?
Well, we don't know. I think this is all too far away, but I think you're going to get on Tuesday night a pretty clear statement of a complex subject in which we have a great stake, a subject on which I think we're all going to stand together and we're going to stand firm. And I hope that out of it will come a long step towards the peace that we'd all like to see.
Gentlemen, I'm sorry to interrupt, but our time is up.
Thank you, Ned Brooks. We'll return with the details about Meet the Press in just a moment.
This is Merrill Muller with a forecast for the future. Watch for these dangerous females. Some are sure to create headlines. Anna, Betsy, Carla, Debbie, Esther, Francis. All will be names of storms in the upcoming hurricane season. Now, we don't want to count hurricanes before they're hatched. We only want to point out that whether it's weather or whether it's stormy international relations, you'll get fast, meaningful coverage from the award-winning worldwide staff of NBC News.
During this week, you'll be reading and hearing many times the phrase, safety is a family affair. It's the theme for National Farm Safety Week. It's a reminder for all farm families to take stock of the hazards that exist around the house, the barn, and machinery. Note the hazards, and then do something about correcting them. According to the National Safety Council, more than 1 million farm residents are injured and nearly 12,000 are killed in accidents annually. There are more accidental deaths in farming each year than in any other major industry. The safety suggestions, warning, facts, and figures offered during this week are not really the end of the farm safety activities, but really only the beginning. During the week and from now on, no matter where you are or what you're doing, ask yourself if the task at hand is being handled as safely as possible. For your sake, for your family's sake, and for the sake of the nation's welfare, farm safety is a family affair. Our Meet the Press panel today included Robert McCormick, NBC News, James Reston, New York Times, Stuart Hensley, UPI, and Lawrence E. Spivak. For a printed copy of today's Meet the Press discussion, send 10 cents in coin and a stamped self-addressed envelope to Merkle Press, 809 Channing Street, Northeast, Washington, D.C. Next week, Meet the Press will have as its guest Franz Josef Strauss, West German Defense Minister. This is NBC. ¶¶